Merkle Media.
Good, everybody. This is Joel Thomas, and this is Free the Rabbits. And how are all the free range rabbits doing out there today? First, I want to say thanks to everybody who's been giving 5-star reviews across the board on all the platforms, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any other of your favorite podcast streaming apps. I just want to say thank you so much. You have helped the show grow so much in just a little over half of a year, and it's been an amazing ride so far, and I look for an even longer journey with all of you. If you're a follower of the show and you haven't given a 5-star review, please go give a 5-star review on whatever platform you're on right now. And if you're new here, wait till you listen to the show, and if you liked it, then go give a 5-star review. I really appreciate it from the bottom of my heart. And for the people that have been asking, how can I donate to the show to help the show grow financially? There's a couple ways you can do it. You can go to YouTube. You can become a member there. There's several different tiers. Also, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/freetherabbits, and you can give a one-time donation, or you can set up a new monthly donation if you'd like to donate monthly. I appreciate everything you guys are doing for the show. Now let's get into it. What's up, guys? This is Joel Thomas, and I am happy to be here with you for another week of Free the Rabbits. And I've got a very interesting topic this week. I feel like I do every week, but in the moment, I feel like it's a very interesting topic. One, we are going to talk about the Great Pyramid. I know that's a very hot topic in the conspiratorial world because of some of the new information that's come out over the past couple of weeks. But I want to say that I was already planning on doing an episode on the Great Pyramid and its correlation to Old Earth. That's why this episode is prefaced with Old Earth. So this is part of the Old Earth series. And by hopefully what you figured out by now, that I am of the mind of the theory that the Great Pyramid has been around for a very, very, very long time. And I'm going to show you today why I think that. And we are going to talk about its connection to the Ark of the Covenant. And also this very interesting information that's come out recently. Now, what I want to do first and foremost, I'm going to start out with the new information that's come out, because I think it's important to talk about what's in the mainstream about the Great Pyramid and what's underneath all of the pyramids on the Giza Plateau, where the Great Sphinx is also located.
plus several other burial sites. But I think it's important to talk about what's being stated that's under there. Also, there is a contingent of mainstream scientists that are saying that it's fake news. So we have to be aware that that's also being pushed as well. So we probably really will never know exactly what's going on, but we can say that there are many sources out there that are reporting this news about what's going on underneath the Giza Plateau, specifically the Pyramid of Khafre. And this is where they found these weird anomalies. And I will show pictures today of 3D renderings of what these archaeologists and scientists have said that they think is underneath this pyramid and essentially all of the pyramids. But the researchers have claimed that they've discovered the legendary halls of Amenti in a vast city beneath Egypt's pyramids of Giza. And I will talk about the halls of Amenti in a little bit because that does tie into Thoth and the Emerald Tablets. And it's important to talk about these Gnostic viewpoints that come out of the Emerald Tablets. And we'll talk about both kind of Emerald Tablets as well, so you guys understand the difference between the two. But we will talk about the Halls of Amenti, what the Halls of Amenti might be. This is going to have Gnosticism riddled all through it. And I'll tell you what I think about it. I think most people by now know what I think about Gnosticism as a whole. I don't think that it's all bad ideas. I want to say that now, because I know some people get the idea that I'm just railing on Gnostics all the time. That's not the case, because in actuality, a lot of the tenets that are a part of Gnosticism aren't bad. They're actually found in the Bible. The problem is when they deviate from the scriptures and start espousing things like Yahweh is evil. And we'll find out today about the demiurge and who's guarding the halls of Amenti, because that's part of this idea. Also, as we talk about what's possibly underneath these pyramids, what's been discovered, I also want to delve into what I've been researching for the past few months as a part of this Old Earth series about the connection with the Ark of the Covenant and the Great Pyramid. Because if you know anything about the Great Pyramid, it's a very odd structure. And we're going to talk about how odd it is today and why that it doesn't seem like that structure was built for the purposes that archaeologists are telling us now. So we will get into that. But first and foremost, I do want to talk about the newest info. It ties to Gnosticism. And then we'll jump into the Ark of the Covenant, and we'll talk about the Great Pyramid and how I believe that the Great Pyramid's been around for millions, possibly billions of years. I want to say this for any people that are new to this channel, and you may be scratching your head, as I know some Christians do from time to time when I start talking about millions and billions of years. Go back and listen to any of the episodes in my Old Earth series, specifically start with the King's List, and then work your way into the real planet Krypton. And I show specifically throughout scriptural text how that you can still believe in creation and you can still believe in millions and billions of years, because I believe that the Bible leaves that door wide open for interpretation on that. And I am an Old Earth proponent. However, if you're a young Earth proponent, we're still on the same team. I think a lot of Christians forget that when they're arguing about all of these theories that are out there. Flat Earth, the newest, hottest one on the block is the Little Season. That's been hot for a little over a year now. And people are drawing lines in the sand to where they won't even talk to other people if they don't think just like them on some of these topics. Mandela Effect's another one. There's people that think that the Mandela Effect's changing the Bible. So you've got these weird sects in the Christian conspiratorial arena, and it's just a bunch of people fighting. And I always ask, have you ever wondered why people don't want to have anything to do with it? Because you're always fighting. And I think that we can agree to disagree on a lot of things, especially when it's left to interpretation. I'm talking about translations. I'm talking about interpretation, because we could look at the most original translations, which would be in the Hebrew or the Koine Greek, and we could still read them and have different interpretations of what those texts mean. So I'm always open to people's interpretations. I'm not against the Little Season or some of these other Christian conspiracy theories per se. I think one of the things I have a difficult time with is the cultish attitudes that become built around these ideas, where people are willing to start their own churches over conspiracy theories because they don't feel like they can connect to other people. And I'll be honest with you, I think that's unbiblical. I think we should be connecting to everyone that we possibly can and not shutting ourselves off. But when it comes to some of those other topics, those are for a different show, for another time. But I wanted to get back to the old earth aspect of it. It's just what I interpret the Bible to say. So if you're not a fan of it, completely understand. And I'm not mad at you either. And I don't look at you in any kind of low tier way like people do whenever someone doesn't agree with their outlook on a specific topic. Because at the end of the day, I could be wrong, but I can tell you the one thing that we should all be right about is treating other people with respect, love, and compassion like Jesus Christ has taught us to do. That's the number one thing that should override anything else. So anything else outside of that is interpretation. So the Giza Plateau is a limestone plateau in Giza, Egypt, the site of the 4th Dynasty Giza Pyramid Complex, which includes the pyramids of Khufu, Khafre, and Menkaure, the Great Sphinx, several cemeteries, a workers' village, and an industrial complex. So there's a lot going on this Giza Plateau. Now, this is where that this mysterious underground energy source slash hidden room slash hidden city is all supposedly been found recently. Now, directly underneath the Pyramid of Khafre is where they say that this stuff is found. However, because it spreads out into an almost city-like existence underneath the earth, it covers the entire Giza Plateau and probably further, to be honest with you. So Italian and Scottish scientists studying the Pyramid of Khafre say the groundbreaking study has redefined the boundaries of satellite data analysis and archaeological exploration. And this was according to spokesperson Nicole Ciccolo, and she's Italian. Now, you know how I am on this show. I don't just see names and I can let it go. I have to go find out who these people are because sometimes it unravels a little something extra to the mystery. And I looked into Nicole Ciccolo, and she has a website called www.nicoleciccolo.it/en. And she is a graphological expert, which was super interesting because she is the spokesperson for this operation, but she's not necessarily a part of this archaeological team. She's just a spokesperson. Now, a graphological expert's report on handwritten text is one of the most difficult to perform, not so much due to the type of analysis itself, but because a person's handwriting undergoes continuous changes. So basically, they analyze all the structural and expressive features of a graphic text in order to look for concrete elements in it so they can match up writings from one text to writings to another. They can find out if the same person wrote it, because as people write through their lives, their writing does change and nuances happen, but they're able to see past that. Now, the one thing that I thought was interesting about these graphological experts, they say, so writing is a series of activities, including cerebral, psychic, neuromuscular, physiopsychic components, mirroring the changeable flow of life, which is never identical to itself. So I thought that was super interesting that psychic and physiopsychic components are a part of this process of being a graphological expert. So the fact that she is a graphological expert and there are components of psychic activity that's a part of this Well, then it started really making me think about why she's on board with this particular project. Is she on board with this project for reasons that we don't exactly know? Because, again, we don't know exactly what these scientists' goal is here. And I'm going to show you how there's one particular mainstream scientist that is against this. However, he's also, and his team have been doing very similar work and did discover something also very weird back in 2017. Now, the CAFRA project is the name of the project. It was led by a Corrado Mangala from Italy's University of Pisa and Filippo Biondi of the University of Strathclyde in Scotland. And they were trying to discover anything that would be new to Giza Plateau's second largest pyramid, the Pyramid of Khafre. Now, the scientists said they located five small room-like structures inside the pyramid using synthetic aperture radar, SAR technology. One structure contained a sarcophagus mistakenly thought to be the pharaoh's tomb, the team said in a press release. Now, SAR technology is a remote sensing technology that uses radar pulses to create high-resolution images of the Earth's surface, even at adverse weather conditions of darkness, by processing the reflected radar signals. Optical satellites rely on sunlight. SAR uses its own radar signals, making it suitable for situations where optical imaging is not possible. So it's a very high-tech way of being able to see through solid objects and see deep into the earth, which apparently these scientists were able to do. Now, the group claims the five structures previously unknown before the images were found in the center of the pyramid. The newly discovered structures are connected to pathways that lead below the surface and are believed to expose hidden rooms and wells under the 4,500-year-old wonder of the world, which I don't think they're off with the second pyramid. And we'll talk more about when I think that the second and third pyramid were built. I think they were built long after the Great Pyramid. So I don't think that the time frame is necessarily off with the two separate pyramids that were built, in my mind, after the Great Pyramid. And honestly, I believe it was far longer after that the Great Pyramid itself was built. Electromagnetic signals were turned into data that unveiled larger infrastructure leading down thousands of feet underground. The eight large vertical structures theorized to be wells or shafts are thought to extend over 6,500 feet across and 2,000 feet below ground. Now, as I'm talking, we're going to be showing you these 3D images that they produced that supposedly show what is underneath these pyramids. Researchers didn't reveal the use of the larger structures that stretch below ground zero, but plan for further analysis and possible excavation to verify the artificial nature of the structures. So they're artificial. This is not something that, in their opinion, that was created by natural causes. So no sort of cave systems or anything like that in their minds. They believe that this was all artificial. The project used two satellites 420 miles up in space to send down radar signals that photographed the pyramids. So they were able to photograph them from above, and then they were able to, with SAR technology, be able to see what's underneath them as well. The hollowed structure consists of spiral pathways leading down farther underground. The group used the data to make what I'm showing you now, rough 3D models estimating what is believed to be hidden from the world's eye. Now, Mangala said, when we magnify the images in the future, we will reveal that beneath it lies what can only be described as a true underground city. Now, I guess the big question is, was this city always underground? Or was this city above ground at some point? You know, what's funny is I thought about when this came out, I was like, man, I bet the Tartaria folk are going absolutely insane over this, because they've been, I don't know if you see those AI pictures that were put out really right when the whole Tartaria movement started getting super hot, and it would show the pyramids above ground, and then it would just show how the pyramids kept going and kept going and kept going, and there was no end. They were just massive. It lends to the idea that there was some massive mud flood that covered the earth And maybe one day, if I'm feeling froggy, I'll touch Tartaria. I've talked about it in the past. It's one of those ones that's super divisive. And I know that once I start bringing a level-headed approach to it, there's going to be people that get 0 to 60 very quickly if you don't believe exactly what has been espoused throughout the conspiratorial community about said subject. I will say this. I think there are some very interesting components when it comes to the Tartaria idea. And I don't think we can throw all of it out, but I also don't think it's what's being pushed by the conspiratorial community either. I think there has to be a balance there. So I do take on board some things, but I do think as a whole, it's got a lot of holes in it. But I wanted to bring that up because as soon as I saw these underground structures, I was already hearing it. There it is. There it is. Not necessarily, because one, it could have been built into the ground. We know that there are underground cities that have been talked about throughout different civilizations and cultures. We know that. Agartha, Shambhala, there are many different ones that have been talked about. So if we're talking about inner Earth or any idea of hollow Earth, even if you don't believe in hollow Earth, we know that there are massive caverns, massive cavernous systems throughout the world. We know about the Mammoth Caves here in the United States, which some scientists and geologists have mapped out the Mammoth Caves going out as far as California and all the way to New York, that it covers almost the entire United States, depending on which geologists are drawing the maps, because nobody really knows how deep and how far out that the Mammoth Caves go. So you have to at least open yourself up to the idea that there are massive caverns all around the world. Now, is the Earth hollow? I don't know. I know that we've heard about hollow Earth for a long time. It's one of those ones where, is it really hollow or they're just massive caverns that go beyond anything that we've ever been to, at least what mainstream science is telling us. I do believe that they've more than likely been to these places, but they're not telling us all of this either, especially if there are things down there they don't really want us to know about. Very similar to this right here, what's being said, obviously skepticism, accusations are being thrown around by some of these mainstream archaeologists and scientists saying it was a hoax. And they said that they did not publish the project with the information for peer review from independent researchers. I don't necessarily think that's indicative of it being fake. It could just be that this group of geologists, scientists, and archaeologists are like, if we put it out there for peer review, you guys are just going to try to slice it up anyway. You already are, especially when you go against the mainstream narrative of what's going on. Because as soon as the idea of there being all of this mysterious caverns and possibly a city and the halls of Amenti, all of these things being talked about, then we got to start asking questions. How long has it been there? Who lived there? Is there people living there now? Is there things living there? There's so many questions you have to ask. And then the narrative of what the pyramids were actually built for, then that becomes an entirely different discussion. And that's what a lot of the mainstream archaeologists and scientists don't want to stir up, because they've been feeding people exactly what they want them to believe, even though I don't think they actually believe what they're espousing. And Zahi Hawass, who is an Egyptian archaeologist, Egyptologist, and former minister of tourism and antiquities, which he held twice, is completely against this. Matter of fact, he said it's completely wrong and fake news. Shocker, right? And he never really gives a reason why that it's fake news. He just comes out and says, hey, look at me. I'm the renowned archaeologist. I held this position of minister of antiquities. You have to believe me. It's very similar to what I talk about a lot on the show, where guys come out with degrees or X amount of years of research on a subject, and they say, you have to believe me. And people do. people in the conspiratorial world do too, especially when those people who have degrees feed them a certain conspiracy theory that they like, they automatically believe it. You'll see this all the time with guys who are linguists who come out and say, no, the scripture's saying this. Let me tell you why it is, because I understand the medical Greek better than anyone else ever has in the history of understanding medical Greek. We see this all the time with all of these different guys coming out. And I'm not saying that education's bad. And I'm not saying that these things can't be important and we shouldn't pay attention to someone who has years of tenure in something. But just know that's not indicative of them telling the truth either. We have to always really have our heads on a swivel when it comes to what anyone's saying. Now, when it comes to this entire idea of what's underneath the Giza Plateau, I'm open to what's being presented as also being fake. Maybe he's right. Maybe it is fake news. Maybe they're setting us up for something else. I'm not saying I buy into this completely, but I will say it's always odd if there's info that comes out and then you've got a bunch of people who are pushing hard against it and they've always been against the narrative of the pyramids in this case being built or being helped from an outside source rather than humans. And Hawass is definitely one of these guys. Now, after he was the Minister of Tourism and Antiquities, he continues to this day to be involved in archaeological projects at Giza and other sites in Egypt. And as of 2017, I was talking to you about this earlier, he headed the science committee overseeing the Scan Pyramids project. And I was like, Scan Pyramids? That sounds an awful lot like what this group is doing to the pyramids now. So let me take a little look at it. Well, the Scan Pyramids mission is an Egyptian international project designed and led by Cairo University and the French HIP Institute. This project aims at scanning Old Kingdom Egyptian pyramids, so Khufu, Khafre, the Bent, and the Red, to detect the presence of unknown internal voids and structures. Check this out. On November 2nd, 2017, the Scan Pyramids team announced through a publication in Nature its third discovery in the Great Pyramid, a plane-sized, previously unknown void named the Scan Pyramid's Big Void. So they're already finding stuff. And they put this out in 2017. So I don't really understand why Hawass is so against this, outside of the fact maybe he didn't discover it, or maybe he did know about it and doesn't want this narrative being pushed that, man, these pyramids were not created by human beings, or if they were, they were helped by an outside source. And once that gets put into the zeitgeist by the mainstream, which I do think is going to happen at some point, once that happens, the entire narrative is going to shift globally. People who have spiritual connections to whatever religion they follow are obviously going to be looking at things differently. I believe they're going to really push the ancient alien theory for sure. I think that's what they've been gearing up towards, especially when it comes to these grays and reptilians. I think it's going to be a big part of it. But I think they want to trickle this out in a way that they can mitigate. And maybe they are. Maybe this is how they're doing it. Maybe they are telling someone like Hawass to say he's against it to give it more credibility. And it could still be true, but maybe there are a lot of different factors at work here to get us all on board with believing what this is, or at least believing what they want us to believe that it is. So Hawass said, this is hilarious, the claim of using radar inside the pyramid is false, and the techniques employed are neither scientifically approved nor validated. That's absolutely not true. It's SAR technology. I just explained to you what SAR technology is. It's some of the best technology when we're talking about being able to look through solid objects. It's actually better when put up against optical satellites and what they're able to do. SAR technology can collect data in any kind of weather, in any kind of conditions. So no, it is a viable option. To say that, I really feel like to say that is just betting on a bunch of people out there who are not going to look anything past this article or the articles out there that are saying that there's nothing to it. Now, there was one researcher at the University of Denver said the claims are exaggerated, as the technology is not advanced enough to create such images. Again, great technology. We know it to be true. We know it to be real. But here we got guys coming out saying that there's no way. Now, we did have some other experts, radar experts, come out. There was one, Lawrence Conyers, said there is a likelihood that the five smaller structures found just below the surface may be there because of the history of the area. So he's saying that, well, they picked up something. And there could have possibly been structures that were there before that this pyramid was built on top of them, which is possible. Now, Chicolo, who we just talked about earlier, Nicole, and her very interesting tie into all this, this graphological expert, she comes out and makes this claim: a remarkably strong correlation between the layout and characteristics of these underground chambers and the legendary halls of Amenti, as described in ancient myths. Now, the halls of Amenti include the fabled Hall of Records, a hidden room believed to be underneath the pyramid complex or the Great Sphinx, containing resources of information about the ancient people of the area and so many other aspects when it comes to the halls of Amenti. Now, when it comes to the Emerald Tablets, we're not going to be talking about the Emerald Tablet, which is a compact and cryptic Hermetic text. And it was a highly regarded foundational text for many Islamic and European alchemists, though attributed to the legendary Hellenistic figure Hermes Trismegistus. The text of the Emerald Tablet first appears in a number of early medieval Arabic sources, the oldest of which dates to the late 8th or early 9th century. So this particular Emerald Tablet that was supposedly written by Hermes Trismegistus talks about the creation of the Philosopher's Stone and how to produce gold artificially. This is a different Emerald Tablet than the one we're talking about now. So I want to make sure that we know the difference between the two. And in that particular Emerald Tablet is where we get the phrase, as above, so below. And this was from the English translation of the Emerald Tablet by Isaac Newton, which I did an episode about the Trinity and Isaac Newton. I'll be doing more episodes on Isaac Newton as well, because I find Isaac Newton absolutely fascinating as an individual. Now, what we are talking about, though, is the Emerald Tablets of Thoth the Atlantean. And this was a book written by Maurice Doriel, who was born Claude Doggins. And he was an American occultist and founder of the what? Brotherhood of the White Temple. Oh! As soon as I saw that, I said, well, this guy's a theosophist, has to be. And you know that I've talked about theosophy a lot on this show, and I've talked about the Great White Brotherhood. I've talked about the secret chiefs. I've talked about the Mahatmas. I've talked about all of these entities that are tied into these theosophists and these occultists, and Maurice Doriel is no different. And he published this book, The Emerald Tablets of Thoth, the Atlantean, in 1940. And nobody knows the exact time frame. It was either the 1940s, the late 1940s, or the early 1950s. There's not a specific date on this book, but this is when he published it. Now, Doriel claimed that during a 1925 visit to the Great Pyramids of Giza, he discovered a set of ancient emerald tablets belonging to the Egyptian deity Thoth, whom he reimagined as a king of Atlantis. Doriel then claimed to have translated the text, which he published as the Emerald Tablets of Thoth the Atlantean. And again, not to be confused with the Hermetic text, the Emerald Tablet, which was said to be written by Hermes Trismegistus, which some people think Hermes Trismegistus was Thoth. And that's a possibility. I think they have quite a few similarities. And I know people like to throw Enoch in that mix as well. I do too, but I do not think that it was the godly Enoch on the lineage of Seth. I believe that this was what I consider to be the evil Enoch, which was Cain's son. There were two Enochs. And one day I may do an entire episode on evil Enoch so people can understand that. Now, what's interesting, in 1930, and this is before this book was published, again, we don't have an exact date on when the book was published, but Maurice Doriel formed the Brotherhood of the White Temple in Denver, and Obviously, he was involved in theosophy. He claimed that in 1931 in Los Angeles, he met two Atlanteans who took him to a cave underneath Mount Shasta. Doriel quickly developed a cosmology focused on the inner earth, describing underground races he claimed to have learned about from the Atlanteans. Doriel developed theories of an underground serpent race, which we've heard plenty of times. He combined all these into a theory that the second half of the 20th century, the serpent race would ally with the Antichrist. And shocker, David Icke is a huge fan of this, as is Billy Carson. And they love this Emerald Tablets of Thoth the Atlantean. I find it fascinating. I'm not saying that there couldn't be some truths in it. I'd love to really know how he supposedly found these tablets and if they were dictated to him or he was pointed in the direction of these tablets from some sort of entity. Because some of that he's not very clear about. And again, he clearly met with some sort of entities in Los Angeles who said they were Atlanteans. And this just really made me think about the Vrilya and the Nordics and some of these other quote-unquote alien races, these Aryan races that are working with these theosophists. And I just did an episode on starseeds where I do go into a lot of that. So if you're interested in me talking about some of these beings that are talking to these occultists and specifically theosophists, go check that episode out. Now, the second tablet, which is the second chapter in this book, because there are 15 tablets that he supposedly found and he turned them into 15 chapters, the Halls of Amenti are one of them. Now, when you dig into Amenti to find out who is Amenti, well, you have to go to Imhotep. And Imhotep means she of the West was a goddess in ancient Egyptian religion representing the necropolises west of the Nile. She was the consort of Aegon, a god who guided Ra through parts of the underworld. Although she was never officially worshipped, she was mentioned in various hymns and passages of the Book of the Dead. But she was very closely linked to Hathor and Isis in their afterlife roles, that she may be less an independent deity and more of an alternate form of these goddesses. So you'll see a lot of these goddess names interchangeable. A lot of god names are interchangeable. They have very similar characteristics. I've always said this about fallen entities in general, whether they're Elohim or angel kind or demonic. What I think is you got a few things going on. Some of these bigger entities will take on different names depending on location or time period. Then you've also got the other side of it where there are other entities that just copy the format from one of these other entities and they just go by a different name, but they do very similar things. I think this is always happened, and I don't think we're ever going to be able to pinpoint it all the way down. But what we can say is these are not good entities. And again, ding, 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 who's showing up? Hathor, again. And if you know anything about the Chris Bledsoe story, Hathor is a huge part of it. And Hathor is in no way, shape, form, or fashion some sort of good entity that's being espoused by people right now, especially in the new age field of research or people that follow the new age movement. Now, her title, She of the West, is not just a statement related to geography, but also related as her role in mythology, because as the sun sets towards the west, it was to be accompanied by death, which was where Imhotep usually reigned. Additionally, Amenti, or Imhotep, was thought to be where the sun set, where the entrance to the underworld was located, although later the term began to associate itself with graveyards and tombs as well. So she is in some way the guardian of the underworld. Some people think a stargate. Some people think some sort of portal. It could be all, right? When we're dealing with technologies that we don't understand, we have to look at the possibility of all possibilities. And I do think that in these Halls of Amenti, I think there's something that we can point to the possibility that this is a real place. Now, we see it show up consistently throughout Gnosticism and a lot of different occult sects throughout history. Now, there's many speculations of what the Halls of Amenti could be. from mystical realms to stargates, like I talked about, to a hidden cavity found under the Sphinx. So technically, if they're saying that they found this Halls of Amenti, or the Hall of Amenti, then yeah, it would be underneath the Sphinx, because they're saying it's massive. It's probably spreading out further from the plateau than even just the plateau. But in Gnosticism, they look at it as more of a spiritual crossing over point. And when you're in the Halls of Amenti is where you're faced with the demiurge. And according to Gnostics, this demiurge is Yahweh. He is the God of the Old Testament, and he presents himself as the one true God, but he's just tricking us. He's not the one true God. He is guarding this place. Now, until we reach the full level of gnosis, of knowledge, of our spirit stripping the ego completely away, we cannot pass this demiurge. We cannot pass Yahweh. Again, I'm just saying what Gnostics believe. And I know there are many different variations of what different Gnostic sects believe. I'm just giving you kind of an overview here. So in this Halls of Amenti, this demiurge Yahweh is blocking us until we essentially strip the ego away enough to where we become greater than Yahweh. We become a God ourselves. And I know Gnostics hate to hear this, but this is exactly what's being espoused. That until we are able to strip that ego away, then we will constantly be reincarnated back into the world until we can finally learn how to do it. It's the matrix. It's the simulation theory. It's the theory of forms, which Plato talks about. It's this idea, even Plato's cave, it's this idea that everything around us is a mirage. It's what we see. It's not really tangible. And until we do that, we cannot move into this pleroma where the monad or the one true God is waiting for us. So then we can become a part of this consciousness, and we move into this other realm, and we get rid of the evil, bad Yahweh and who he is. You know, lately I've been running into people who are Christians who believe that Yahweh is evil. And I was actually having a conversation with one of these people, and I asked some simple questions, and I was like, you know, this is completely Gnostic ideology. Well, I mean, the greatest lies are hidden in truths. And I'm like, to a point, but Gnosticism completely strips away the divinity and power of Christ. It also strips away who God is. And to say that that is a Christian ideology, I have a tough time with that, a very tough time with that. You either believe the word or you don't believe the word. That's just in my opinion, and that's how I feel about it, and I'm always going to speak how I feel on this show. Now, this Pleroma, we're going to the Halls of Amenti. We have reincarnated enough, we stripped our ego enough that Yahweh can't stop us. We're moving into the Pleroma. And this is called the string theory or the M theory. The three-dimensional physical world has at least 7 dimensions above it. This totals 10 dimensions in all. The Halls of Amenti are situated in the higher dimensions that are ruled by pure energetic entities that many different religions have called Lord, the God Almighty, Yahweh, and Allah. And according to Gnostics, this entity is a bouncer at the gates, what Plato calls the demiurge. And the demiurge has many shapes and forms and guards with the archons, the gateways to the Pleroma. So until we are able to become godlike or gods, we're not going to be able to get past this. We're just going to continue to get reincarnated back down to earth, and it's going to be this constant process, which I don't buy at all. I'll be completely honest with you. It's what the New Age movement took on board with Alice Bailey when she came along, and it's mixed in with all these different occult ideologies. Now, these energies, the demiurges and archons, distort the pure vibrations that are emitted by the highest level, the Pleroma. It is everyone's duty to overcome this. That's what humanity's real task here on Earth is. Now, just so you understand, Pleroma is not in and of itself this one thing. So it's actually a Greek word for fullness, and it refers to the totality, divine powers, or the spiritual universe as the abode of God. Now, this is a concept of Gnosticism, but it's also used, the word pleroma is used in the New Testament as well. So this is where probably some of these Gnostics get this idea that the New Testament is the only true word, and the Old Testament is not a part of the Bible in their mind, because they will pull these ideas from Christ's own words. But again, these are just Greek words. Pleroma is a Greek word for fullness. It doesn't mean this place, even though Gnostics have turned it into this place, which apparently we can go through the halls of Amenti to get to. Now, the New Testament text in Colossians and Ephesians use the word pleroma several times. Ephesians 3:19 uses pleroma as the fullness of God. Colossians 1:19 uses it in the fullness of Christ. And the church can be seen as the pleroma or complement of Christ in Ephesians 4:13. So again, back to pleroma is not a bad thing. Again, if you want to use it in the way that it was given to us in the Greek language, then obviously it's like any other word that's out there. It can be used and have multiple meanings, but it is actually used in the New Testament. And this directly ties in to the Emerald Tablets supposedly written by Thoth. And in those Emerald Tablets, Thoth says, on earth, man is in bondage, bound by space and time to the earth plane. So Thoth is probably, in my opinion, the beginning of Gnosticism, even though the term Gnosticism wasn't really used until after Christ or in AD. But the Gnostic ideas have been around since, I believe, the dawn of time. I don't think they've ever changed. As soon as there were beings that were around for fallen entities to manipulate, I believe that Gnosticism has always been a huge part of this. Now, the Gnostics will also tell you about the Halls of Amenti, that ignorance is what keeps the Halls of Amenti on earth intact. When the ego is not aware, it is just a lower reflection of something higher, the soul. The ignorance keeps the ego in charge of all actions, thus keeping the soul mired in the material plane. Now, I'm going to say this. This is one of those parts of Gnosticism that I agree with. I think that we should strip the ego. I don't think that we need to have an ego. And I think that ego could get in the way of a lot of things. Just at a basic human level, if we're egotistical, we're going to treat others with disrespect. We're going to step on people to get what we want. We're going to believe things about ourselves that aren't true, which is also going to feed into narcissism and a lot of other things. So I do agree with that part of it. I just don't agree with the fact that we're going to strip our ego enough down to become greater than Yahweh. And I don't buy that. Essentially becoming gods ourselves. And this goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden, which, oddly enough, there are Gnostic sects that believe that Satan is the good guy and God or Yahweh is the bad guy. So there's all these different variations within Gnosticism too. They don't agree at all either. You know, people point to Christians and all the different denominations and them not agreeing. Well, Gnostics don't agree altogether either, just like any other religion. There's all these different sects that come out of different religions, and people argue and fight sometimes over the dumbest stuff. Now, the Bible does talk specifically about giving up the ego. Luke 9:23, and he said to all, if any want to come after me, let them deny themselves and take up their cross daily and follow me. So deny yourself. But the key is take up your cross daily and follow me. That's the main difference between Gnosticism and following Jesus, who is divinity, who is God, who is part of the Trinity, who is Yahweh. That's the difference. Matthew 16:24-25, then Jesus told his disciples, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. So again, just a different variation of the verse in Luke 9:23. We have Romans 12:1-2. Therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. Not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds. Then you will be able to discern God's will, what is good and pleasing and perfect. And there are tons of other verses that are very similar. I just want to read a few to say that, hey, the Gnostics aren't wrong about that. we do need to strip our egos. That's a big part of sacrificing oneself to become greater, to become intimate with our own purpose and what we're supposed to be. The only difference is we're following Jesus and his divinity, his Godhead, into our purpose, as opposed to us figuring it out because we're stripping our ego ourselves and we're going to become godlike. Now, according to the Gnostics, when it comes to the Hall of Amenti, the entity God or Yahweh mentioned in the Old Testament is disobedient from its place of origin, the Pleroma or pure love. According to Thoth and other Gnostic sources, the Demiurge is not the highest entity, but represents itself as the highest entity. So that's the trickery, right? The guy telling you he's the greatest is not the greatest. You got to get past him. He's the gatekeeper, literally. The gatekeeper of the portal or the Stargate or the gateway of the underworld to pass through to then get to this Pleroma or pure love, this place where the monad or the one is waiting for us. The God of the Old Testament is the bouncer at the door, but represents himself as the big boss. The entity or deity disturbs the universal truth like a color filter in front of a camera. It makes it even harder to find the truth. So this is that muddling of taking what is true and then turning it into something negative. It literally is the definition of as above, so below. We see this all the time, the inversion tactics of the enemy. Now, this was interesting that I ran across when I was digging into the Halls of Amenti, and this is classic Gnosticism 101, cherry-picking verses and then not even reading them or translating them correctly. And then when people see that, people that don't read the Bible at all will say, oh, yeah, you're right, and then buy into it completely. So the Demiurge stated, I am God and there's no other God beside me. It was saying, in other words, I love it, on personal Gnostic translation, there are other gods, not only beside me, but even above me. That's not what it says at all. And I'm going to actually pull up the verse in Isaiah and read to you what it says, and then I'll talk to you what it means in the Hebrew as well, because that is an incorrect translation. It never says, not only besides me, but even above me. Now, there are other gods. I completely agree with that. I agree with the divine council, the Elohim. I believe there are negative gods, all that I'm completely on board with. But as far as the Demiurge or Yahweh saying that there are gods above me, there's nothing in scripture that says that. Isaiah 43:9, remember what happened long ago, for I am God. And there's no other. I am God, and there is none like me. If you'll see, not even in the English translation does it even say that. And I read that in the Berean Standard, which I'm a big fan of. And Hebrew, God in this verse is not Yahweh. It's actually El. So this is a prime example of God having multiple names that are used for him throughout the Old Testament. It's not always Yahweh. There are several other names that are used for God, Jehovah being one of them as well. So we have to understand that God, especially when the writers were talking about different attributes of God, they would use different names for him because those names represented those attributes. Now, there is no other I am God. This time it's Elohim. So Elohim can also denote singular or plural, and it's singular in this case. Now, there is none like me. None in the Hebrew is epis. It means ceasing, then, end, extremity, non-existence. The cessation of naught is what it means. Now, Isaiah's use of the word to express non-existence is indeed vivid. When he describes the apocalyptic cataclysm of the last times, which will overtake the enemies of the Lord, he declares that nobles and princes will not be there for the roll call. When extolling the transcendent greatness of the Lord of earth, the same prophet evaluates all nations as nothing compared to him. 40:17, that's Isaiah 40:17. In most scathing denunciations of idolatry on record, Isaiah castigates the idols of the pagan nations, especially of Babylon, as being nothing. And this is using that word, epes, E-P-E-S. Their work is nothing, these gods, and their images are non-entities. And this is Isaiah 41, 12, 24, and 29. This word, epes, is used. So This word means ceasing, the end, extremity, non-existence. So in this verse in Isaiah 43:9, this cannot be mistranslated into there are other gods not only beside me, but even above me. No, in the Hebrew, it means ceasing, none, non-existent. There is none like me at all, period. So I wanted to read the actual verse and then look into the Hebrew definition of some of these words to showcase how it's very easy, if you're just trying to prove a point, to cherry pick a verse, switch a couple words out, and say, hey, this is what it means. Now that I've explained in various ways what the Hall of Amenti or the Halls of Amenti are, and I'm sure I still didn't give you a great definition because none of us actually know what they are, but there are a lot of different ideas and theories of what's going on down there or what did go on down there. And Thoth being a huge part of it. My personal opinion, and this is just me, what I think, I do believe there's some sort of portaling or Stargate system there. If we're going to take on board Stargates as being a part of angelic travel and Nephilim travel, which I've talked about in the past, we have to introduce the idea that this also houses some sort of Stargate or portaling system. Now, I would encourage people to go back and listen to the Enochian Stargate of Nebuchadnezzar, which was one of my earliest episodes, and that will directly tie into this when we're talking about the Ark of the Covenant, because I talk about how the Ark of the Covenant was used in correlation with a Stargate, or what was talked about as the fiery furnace of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, again, this is a lot of theorizing, but there are plenty of text and other materials that I've looked through to be able to come up with how that would work when it came to Nebuchadnezzar. And today we're going to do something very similar, where I'm going to show you how some of the information out there can be looked at in such a way that the Ark of the Covenant, or what I think something similar to the Ark of the Covenant, was connected to the Great Pyramid. And if we're going to suggest that there's some sort of Stargate or some sort of portaling system that's in these halls of Amenti that is below, which Chicolo is suggesting that they found the halls of Amenti, then we have to wonder, where's the power source? You know, what was working in conjunction with it to make it work? And I think today I'll at least offer up a theory on how that could work. Now, the Great Pyramid of Giza is the largest Egyptian pyramid. It served as the tomb of Pharaoh Khufu, which there's supposedly a sarcophagus there with no lid and nothing in it. Never has been found anything in it. There's never even been a story about bones even being found. And the entire structure on the inside is absolutely fascinating in the sense it's nothing like the other pyramids. The walls have no hieroglyphs, nothing on them outside of tomb raiders or people running up in there with graffiti. But it's nothing like any of the other pyramids. And I think there's a reason for that. And I think the Great Pyramid was built long before the other two. And I think the other two were built as a way to try to mimic the original Great Pyramid. Now, to move into who I think built the Great Pyramids and how that I don't think that humans were able to do it, we can actually look to 1978. And with direct funding from Nippon TV or Japanese TV, the Japanese decide that they want to prove that the ancient Egyptians built the pyramids by the primitive method of construction, which consisted of cutting stones with chisels and stacking them by lifting ropes and other manual means. The research team began its work, where the two parties agreed that the entire experiment would be transformed into a documentary film for Japanese TV. In agreement with the Egyptian government, provided that the small experiment pyramid is removed after it's completed and the area is completely cleaned up and returned to what it was. So they actually built this small scale pyramid next to the Great Pyramid. And I'm going to show you some pictures up here while we're talking. If you're on YouTube or Rumble, you'll get to see them and you'll see this little janky pyramid that they tried to build. Now, the initial planning of the experiment stipulated that a 20 meter long pyramid would be built using terraces with each stone weighing 4 tons and to involve 100 Egyptian workers to implement the experiment. Now, despite all of the technological progress available at the time of implementing the Japanese experiment in 1978 compared to what was available thousands of years ago in the building of the Great Pyramid, and despite the brilliant minds that participated in the study and implementation of the experiment from scientists in several fields, the team was exposed to several confusing shocks during the experiment. In the beginning, the team found that the issue of cutting stones, each weighing 4 tons using primitive tools such as chisels and others, is very difficult. Requires a huge cost and a very long time. So they only had to reduce the height of the pyramid to be implemented from 20 to 10 meters only and reduce the weight of the stone from 4 to 1 ton only, and the use of electric saws in the process of cutting stones, which was the first use by them of modern technological means in violation of the main objective of the experiment. So they already failed. They're using electric saws. They already shrunk it from 20 to 10 meters. And they shrunk the blocks from 4 to 1 tons. Now, the team discovered the failure of all means, the beginning of transporting stones from Tora to the Giza Plateau via the Nile, which was suggested all along that this is what the Egyptians were doing. So they used technology for the second time through the use of flat ships that carry the weight of the stones and move them in the waters of the Nile. When the stones reached the shores near the pyramid, about 50 workers could not move one stone, but several centimeters, which means that the experiment could have taken several years only to be able to transport the stones from the Nile River to the place of construction. So they had to extend a railway using small iron carts carrying each stone. After all these difficulties as a result of the huge weight of the stones, they naturally expected the difficulty of the next step of lifting the stones and placing them in the allotted place inside the floor of the pyramid, which prompted them to use large cranes. And they used these cranes to stack the stones, and they even had to bring a helicopter along to help set the stones precisely in their place. They eventually built this 10-meter pyramid in the exact location next to the Giza pyramids, but the experiment proved to be a failure by all standards. They had to use modern technology in every case to even try to get it close to what was built with the Great Pyramid. So this was just a experiment that was done in 1978 by Nippon TV or Japanese TV to prove that the ancient Egyptians actually built the Great Pyramid. They said, we're just going to build a small scale one. It's not going to be that hard. We're actually going to use all the tools that mainstream science and archaeology has been telling us forever that built the Great Pyramid, and none of it worked. And it's funny, this story is really swept under the rug. You can find stuff about it if you look for it. But it's proof that even on a small scale, and even with the modern technology they did use, it still couldn't come close to anything that was involved in building the Great Pyramid. So we have to ask the question, who built the Great Pyramids? Now, I'm of the mind that the original Great Pyramid was not built by humans. And I'm going to tell you why I think that here in a little bit. But I do think the other two pyramids may have been built by humans in conjunction with possible fallen entities, possibly Nephilim giants. There's a lot of different theories that are rolling around on how those could have been built. I'm open to all of them. I'm not saying I know the answer to it. All I'm saying is what mainstream archaeology has told us about the pyramids and how they were built are almost virtually impossible. And I'm not saying humans aren't smart, and I'm a big proponent of human beings being very intelligent. I'm just saying that from the standpoint of what was said by mainstream archaeology and science on how they were built by humans isn't possible. Now, we're humans using some sort of ancient technology to build the pyramids, that I can get behind more. So if we want to go down that road as well, I'm very open to that too. Now, one of the other things that's interesting when it comes to the Great Pyramid and just the pyramids of Giza in general is that they correlate with Orion's belt stars, Mintaka, Alnitak, and Al-Nilam. Now, Mintaka, also known as Delta Orionis, is a multiple star system and the westernmost star in Orion's belt, meaning the belt in Arabic, and is a bright variable star of spectral class 09. Its location is in the constellation Orion, specifically as part of the Orion belt, along with Al-Nilam and Alnitak. So these stars are located to directly correlate to the pyramids. So you guys, the question there too, how did these ancient people, now again, I'm going to add this in. I do believe that ancient man had technology that we don't think that they had. So I do think that there is a level of that too, but we also have to ask where they got the technology from, if that's the case, or if they were in contact with some sort of entities that were helping them position these pyramids so that they directly lined up to the Orion's belt stars. Now, it's believed among Egyptologists that the Great Pyramid was built over a 20-year period during Egypt's fourth dynasty. Now, this is between 2613 and 2498 BC as a tomb for Pharaoh Khufu. Now, the conventional understanding also dates the beginning of Egyptian civilization roughly to 3000 BC. Now, there was a discovery that came out by a Belgian engineer, Robert Bouval, and researcher Graham Hancock, which I'm sure a lot of people know who Graham Hancock is. I know he's very controversial. I know he's been on Joe Rogan several times. I am inclined to think that Graham Hancock gets some stuff right, right? Like, I don't think he's wrong about everything. Now, I know that's depends on who you're talking to when it comes to Graham Hancock. So I'm always very cautious with anybody that presents information, but I did find this piece very interesting. Now, they thought to compare the alignment of the Giza pyramids to known star charts. Looking at relative time when the pyramids were supposed to have been built, 2500 BC, they did not find a match. So they continued to search into astronomical antiquity and found an exact match point more than five times older than the structure's supposed construction. So they used astronomical computer programs and they dialed back the skies over Giza to the supposed date of the construction of the pyramids, 2500 BC. They couldn't find a match. And this was during the astronomical age of Taurus, represented by the bull. So they decided to move back to the age of Leo, which I thought was interesting too, because you got the Sphinx that's a part of this equation as well. So if they're in the age of Leo, and we're talking about astrological charts, and we know from the Book of Enoch that fallen angels taught mankind astrology. So if we're going to go down that road, this makes perfect sense that they would dial it back to the age of Leo. So they dialed these star fields back thousands of years and they found a match. In 10,500 BC, the pyramids matched Orion's belt. The Sphinx was looking directly at, guess what? The constellation of Leo. Ha-ha! So this period of time, 10,500 BC, marked the dawning of the age of Leo. And even more astonishingly, at that date, the pyramids and the Sphinx's position relative to the nearby River Nile matched Orion and Leo's position relative to the Milky Way. So all of this is aligning during this particular period of time. It doesn't mean that this is when the pyramids were built, but they're trying to find just some sort of time frame where they would have aligned with these stars and constellations in the way that they're supposed to. And I know I did an episode with John from 21CD Podcast where we talked about American Egypt and Egyptians being in America. And we talked about some of the interesting structures that are in the Grand Canyon, Tower of Set, Horus Temple, Tower of Ra, Osiris Temple, the Isis Temple, and all of these match up to star systems as well. So we got to ask the question, how long have they been around for? We don't know. And I guess one of the big questions through all this is, how could ancient people thousands and thousands of years ago, even millions of years ago, could have knowledge of such a system. They didn't have GPS. They didn't have modern technology. They didn't have satellite telemetry, computer accuracy, none of that. But somehow they knew exactly where to place them. So in my opinion, if humans built these structures, and I think at least two of them were built by humans, but I also think they were built alongside something else. And we know that from the dawn of time, that in all cultures, all religions, that mankind has been in contact with some sort of beings. Call them whatever you want. There's a ton of different names for them. But they derived this knowledge from these beings who would have intricate knowledge of constellations and the stars. They would be able to align this stuff up to perfection. Now, one of the other interesting things when it comes to the Great Pyramid itself is at one time, it had highly polished limestone that covered the entire pyramid and made it shine like a star on Earth. It said that it would have been so bright, it would have been seen from the moon and some of the other planets. And the idea is that the Great Pyramid itself was a reflection of the heavens. So I'm going to get into a little bit different train of thought when it comes to the Great Pyramid, because I know there's a big push to say that the pyramids were built by fallen angels, that these negative Elohim built them either with humans or before humans. I think personally, this is just my theory, that the Great Pyramid itself was built by angel kind. It was not built by humans. I think the other two came later. And there is a lot of archaeological evidence that they were built after the Great Pyramid. So, and it could have been a huge gap of time in between that too. But if we're talking about this Great Pyramid, which is built with incredible precision, way more than the other two, that it would have been built by a precursor to us. Now, in my opinion, and you know my thoughts on old Earth and there being angel civilizations, I lend to the idea that the Great Pyramid, if it was a reflection of the heavens, that the Great Pyramid itself was not built from anything evil, that it was a reflection of Yahweh, a reflection of God. And that was its original purpose, is like a monument, because it's built literally on the exact center of the Earth's landmass and perfectly aligned with the four cardinal points of the compass. So if it was built to be that center piece of the Earth, and it contained, especially then, an enormous amount of power that emanated from it, and it was built as a monument to God, then its original purpose was nothing negative. And as I'm digging a little deeper here in a little bit, I want to talk about its correlation to the Ark of the Covenant, and that the Ark of the Covenant could have actually been a second ark that was told by God to Moses to build, and it would have been the second version of an ark that had already previously been around. Now, again, we're getting to the levels of speculation and theorizing. And I always tell people on this show that when I start speculating and theorizing and looking into some of these things that are in a little bit wilder scope. So don't take my word as the exact word, because I know there are a lot of podcasters out there that do that. And they want you to follow what they're saying. And let's build a cult around it. I'm going to theorize, and then that's built a massive cult around it as well, which I'm definitely not trying to do. So again, take this with the theorizing mind as I'm presenting information. And you have to ask, without GPS, without some of the technology we have now, how would they know to build this on the Earth's center? And obviously, ley lines run through here as well. Also, most people think the Great Pyramid has four sides. It actually does not. It has eight sides. And this was discovered by Percy Robert Clifford Groves, who was a senior British air strategist, and he served with the British Army and Royal Air Force. And he was flying his plane over the pyramid, and he discovered that from the aerial view that he had, it was actually multifaceted, eight-sided object, and it had concavity at its core and is indented down the middle of each side in perfect precision. So again, we're back to this perfect precision, and I'm about to show you mathematically how precise this Great Pyramid is. It's mind-blowing how precise that it is. And to think that humanity was pulling that off during that period of time. And again, I know humans are smart, but they wouldn't have had this intricate knowledge of the heavens and also be able to know that in this exact location, this is in the center of the earth. And we were talking about some of these mathematical equations that are attached to the Great Pyramid. Check out some of these. If we take twice the pyramid's perimeter at the bottom of the granite coffer and multiply it by 10, we get the sum of the sun's mean radius, 270.45378502 pyramid inches times 10 degrees, which is 427,316 miles. The height of the pyramid times 10 feet equals the average distance to the sun. And that equation is 5,813.2355653 multiplied by 10 feet, 1 mile divided by 63,291.58 equals 91,848,500 miles. The mean distance to the sun is half the length of the diagonal of the base times 10 inches. The height of the pyramid multiplied by 10 feet represents the mean radius of the Earth's orbit around the sun. I know that was a bunch of mathematical gobbledygook to some people, but I thought it was important to talk about some of these mathematical revelations because the pyramid itself, the Great Pyramid itself, is literally tied into the sun's mean radius, the mean distance to the sun, the mean radius of the Earth's orbit around the sun, the mean distance to the moon. All these things are so precise and so mathematically accurate. How, again, I'm going to ask the question, how were humans able to pull that off back then without some form of technology? Which, again, I like the argument there were some sort of ancient technology that was possibly given to them that helped ancient man be able to pull off some of these things. However, I'm not in the camp to think that humans built the Great Pyramid. And that's just my personal opinion. And I could be wrong. Maybe humans did. But I do think that the Great Pyramid itself, and I lent to this theory that it was built as a monument to Yahweh, a monument to God, built by good angels, and then later was bogarted after possibly the flood in between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2, which is the basis of the old earth theory that the earth was created, there were angelic civilizations and all kinds of other things. And then because of mayhem, there was a flood that happened. And then there was basically a reboot. And then Adam and Eve were brought along. And then we brought into this new wave, which brought us into another flood, which is actually the last flood that would ever happen. And that was the promise that God gave to Noah. But I am in the camp of believing that the Great Pyramid was built before that flood, before Adam and Eve, and that it was built by angelic civilizations. Now, we're talking about mathematical revelations and mathematical coincidences that are connected to this Great Pyramid, and it's proof, in my opinion, of it being very difficult for humans to pull this off during a period of time where I just don't think it was possible without some help. Now, one of the most stunning mathematical coincidences comes from the very center of the Grand Gallery inside the pyramid itself. And we find that the latitude for this location is 29°5845.28 north. Written as degrees alone, the latitude is 29.9792458 degrees north. While this number isn't very interesting by itself, let's think about this. The speed of light in a vacuum is 299,000,000 792,458 meters per second. The latitude of the location of the Great Pyramid is 299792458. The speed of light, which I just said, 299792458. It's the same number. So why is the latitude of the Great Pyramid the same as the speed of light in a vacuum? So now we're getting to this Stargate part. Because if the Great Pyramid is above the Halls of Amenti and a civilization underground or a civilization from the past or a giant city, and say there is a portal of Stargate there, this would tie right into the idea of the speed of light in a vacuum and being able to travel through these Stargates at the speed of light. You have to ask the question, why are these numbers the exact same? Why was this pyramid built like this? There had to be, again, in my opinion, some sort of help, or this was built by angel kind in a time period before Adam and Eve. Now, the Great Pyramid also has some great connectivities to the Bible itself. If we look at the verses of Isaiah 19, 19 through 20, it talks specifically of the Great Pyramid, or at least what some theologians and scholars believe is being talked about. Isaiah 19, 19, in that day, there will be an altar to the Lord in the heart of Egypt, and a monument to the Lord at its border. Now, according to some guys like Steve Quayle and Thomas Horn and some of these guys, they believe that these verses are talking about a time period in the ancient past. And you'll find this a lot in Isaiah. And I use Isaiah a lot as an example. Isaiah 19, 20, it will be a sign and a witness to the Lord of hosts in the land of Egypt, for they shall cry unto the Lord because of the oppressors, and he shall send them a savior and a great one, and he shall deliver them. Now that's talking about Moses. But this connection right here, if you take each letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and they all have a numeric value, when you add up all the letter values in the Hebrew alphabet for Isaiah 19, 19 through 20, you get 5,449. It's the Great Pyramid's exact height. It's crazy to think about. How is the two verses where Isaiah seemingly seems to be talking about the Great Pyramid, because he's talking about an altar to the Lord in the heart of Egypt and a monument to the Lord at its border, why is it in the Hebrew alphabet numerical value of Isaiah 19, 19 through 20, it comes up with the Great Pyramid's exact height? It's just a lot of these quote unquote coincidences that just keep coming up when it comes to the Great Pyramid. And that's why I believe that the Great Pyramid was not built by fallen entities, but was built by angel kind who worshiped and glorified Yahweh. And this was built as a monument to him. Now we're going to get into the Ark of the Covenant, or what was maybe the precursor to the Ark of the Covenant. Now, I know there's some guys out there who believe that the Ark of the Covenant is a part of the Great Pyramid's equation. I don't think so, because there's too much evidence that the Ark of the Covenant was built by Moses long after the Great Pyramid had been around. So I don't think that the Ark of the Covenant was before Moses, and Moses somehow got it. Now, I know there's some occultists out there and some Gnostics that believe that Moses stole the Ark of the Covenant. That's a completely different show for another time, and maybe I'll get into that. But according to the Bible, this was built with direct specifications from God to Moses. And the odd part, though, is when we look at the king's chamber. And there is one piece of furniture in the king's chamber. It's a box, and it is very close in size to the Ark of the Covenant. And the room is said to have the same cubic volume as the bronze laver in Solomon's temple. Now, we have to ask, why is this box, this sarcophagus is what they're telling us it is, but it's got no lid, there's never been any bones found in it. Why is it almost within the same parameters as the size of the Ark of the Covenant. Now, I know there's some guys out there who will say that it is the exact size. And they'll say stuff like, almost precisely to the same specifications. It's close. Now, the people who are the ones to push back on this, they will look at the measurements of the Ark of the Covenant, and they'll look at the measurements of the sarcophagus. And when you're looking at it from what people think a cubit is, it's a little more off than it is on. And I looked at some of the numbers, and they didn't quite add up the way that some of the people were espousing that it did. But Charles Piazza Smith, in his book in 1864, Our Inheritance in the Great Pyramid, was one of the first to make this claim. Now, he doesn't accept any of the standard lengths for cubits, and he prefers instead to adopt the conversion of one cubit to 12.5 pyramid inches. And I talked about pyramid inches earlier. There's a lot of people, when they look at the pyramids, they use what is called pyramid inches, which are slightly longer than an imperial inch. So Piazza Smith calculated the arc was 62.5 by 37.5 by 37.5 pyramid inches, roughly the same in imperial inches. From this, he tried to deduce the maximum and minimum volume of the arc by imagining how thick the gold cover wood used to build it could have been. This yielded a range of between 1.75 and 1.8 inches. Thus, he imagined an interior volume of between 71,282 and 71,213 cubic pyramid inches. He therefore compared this favorably to the 71,250 cubic pyramid inches calculated for the Great Pyramid Coffer. So when we're using these calculations, they're right within the same parameters. Now, you're going to have people who come along and they'll do different variations of how to add this up. And I've done some of the different variations as well. And depending on how you look at cubits, it's going to shift that. So I'm very cognizant of this. I'm not here to say that this is an exact science. I'm just saying what some of the research that is out there is saying. I know Steve Quayle is a big proponent of this sarcophagus being the same size as the Ark of the Covenant. And I think if we look at it from the aspect of if that's the case, and we know that there's no lid on it, it's just an empty box, what was in this box? And the way that the Great Pyramid has been laid out, even before all this new information that's come out, was said to have been able to power up something, right? It was creating energy. Now, obviously, with the new information, we see these giant coils, it looks like, that goes all the way down. Some people think those are some sort of energy source too, which is highly possible. But if we want to look at what this box represents or what could have been in this box, and we say that this Great Pyramid was built as a monument to Yahweh, we go way out on a speculative field, but again, several researchers over the past couple hundred years have suggested that this sarcophagus could have housed an ark-like object. So I'm going to propose this idea. And again, several other researchers who I read and just by my own theorizing as well, that there may have been a pre-ark to the original ark that was used to power this Great Pyramid, or at least house the energy that was used from what the Great Pyramid itself was able to draw in. And I know this is, we're getting into speculation big time, but it's very odd that these objects are very similar in size. Now, again, I know some people who think the Ark of the Covenant itself was there. I don't think so. But if God told Moses to build this ark, and it was built off a blueprint that had already been around in the past, maybe no longer in existence, maybe God took it away, right? And it was used to power a stargate that's underneath the Great Pyramids, or power something else for all we know. then it would make sense that it was some sort of Ark-like technology. And I talked about in the Enochian Stargate of Nebuchadnezzar how that there is some great evidence to suggest that the Ark itself was hooked up to a Stargate that Nebuchadnezzar was running in Babylon. So if we're going to suggest that, then we got to suggest this is a possibility as well. And lastly, I want to take a look at the polished limestones. And you're going to find this super fascinating, again, with the numbers. I feel like I'm on some sort of numerology or gematria kick today. And I'm actually not, but it just so happens that numbers and dimensions are a huge part of this. So of the polished limestones that originally adorned the surface of the pyramid, they were sealed with a material so strong they would break anywhere but at the seams. There were 144,000 of them. Where have you heard 144,000 before? Book of Revelation. Revelation 7, 4. I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 from all the tribes of Israel. Revelation 7, 5 through 8 specifies 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes except for the tribe of Dan who were sealed. Revelation 14, 1. And I looked and behold, a lamb standing on Mount Zion with him, 144,000 who had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads. Now, there's a lot of different ideas of what the 144,000 are. Some people think it's a literal number of Jews who will be saved during the tribulation. Some people think it's a symbolic number because 12 times 12 times 1,000 is 144,000. And that's a symbolic representation of completeness and fullness with 12 representing the tribes of Israel and the apostles and the 1,000 representing a multitude. So there are a lot of different, some people think there's only 144,000 that can be saved, which is crazy talk, which is not biblical at all. But there are people that think that. But the number, 144,000, is also an esoteric number and is found in many places, not just in the Bible. We can go to the Mayan long count calendar, which is an ancient calendar stretching back thousands of years. The long count was developed by Maya to track extremely long periods of time. One can see that in the largest cycle of the long count is the Bactan at precisely 144,000 days, equal to approximately 394.25 years. So that's super interesting that we've got 144,000 popping up again. And you're going to see this shift between 144,000 to 144 to 1,440 days. So as long as the 144 is in there, it all ties into this, these esoteric meanings that are used throughout that tie back into this great pyramid, this 144,000 stones that were used to build the great pyramid. Now, if you'll remember, on my last Old Earth episode, I did called The Real Planet Krypton. I talked about the planet Rahab and how that the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter is partially the remnants of this giant planet that Lucifer or Hillel ruled over during ancient Earth. We're talking a few billion years ago. But in that asteroid belt, and we talked about this on the episode, there is an object that is far greater in size than others. It's Ceres, and it's a dwarf planet. Now, it is the largest single object within the field with an orbital period of some 1,680 days. Now, there are several guys out there that theorize and put together some compelling arguments that the main bodies of the solar system were once in ideal configuration. And at the time, the Earth possessed exactly 360 days per year. Now, in the ordering of the system, the planet Ceres possesses precisely four times the ideal Earth orbital period. So 360 times four is what? 1440 days. So we're back to the 144, 1440, 144,000. So interestingly enough, the remnants series of planet Rahab, of this planet Krypton, which I've already talked about, its orbital period is of the same as the stones on the Great Pyramid, the 144,000 Revelation, the Mayan long count calendar, I mean, even in the Fibonacci sequence, part of the numeric sequence, you can see the presence of the key value 144 as part of the generation of the golden proportion. So even in the Fibonacci sequence, 144 is a major key value in the system. And we have to wonder what the 144 means outside of what we know in Revelation. But to tie it all back into this great pyramid, it's built with 144,000 stones precisely. And it's connected to not only the Bible, but some of these other esoteric avenues as well. And to wrap this up, because I know this is a wild episode. I know there's probably some people right now that are throwing their fist up in the air and saying, you're theorizing like crazy. And that's what we do here. I'm going to talk about the wild stuff. I've told you that from the get-go, but I'm also not going to buy into everything either. I'm just throwing out a theory of what I think with all this different research I've done, what I think the Great Pyramid was originally created to be, which I think there's an argument to be made that it was not built by fallen entities. It could have been bogarted down the road by fallen entities. As a matter of fact, I think that fallen entities in conjunction with humans built the other two pyramids to try to recreate what was special and what was original. And if you know anything about the other two pyramids, they're not even close to the precision of the Great Pyramid itself. So that's my take on it. That's my take on what information has been brought out recently. I'm not saying I buy into it wholly. There has to be a reason that it was released and everyone was allowed to see it. So they're either prepping us or maybe these guys really did get some info out without some of the other major organizations knowing about it. I highly doubt it, but I do think there's a reason this info got out. I think they want us to know. And I think they're leading up to a point where they're going to tell us that the Great Pyramids were not built by humans, at least not wholly. And they're going to give us who these beings are. And whatever they tell us, it's probably not going to be true. All right, guys, I had a blast today. I always have a blast on the show. This was a fun episode for me because I love getting into speculative areas and then walking away knowing I could be dead wrong. So there's that too. But I had a blast doing it. Guys, make sure you give a 5-star review on any platform you can. If you're on YouTube or Rumble, make sure you're commenting, make sure you're liking, sharing, subscribing. It really helps the show grow and it gets the algorithms worked up and it gets the show out to a lot of people that wouldn't normally get it. Now, on the way out, we're going to play my song Plato's Cave. I thought that would be very fitting because of what I talked about in this episode. Again, guys, I really appreciate everything you've done to help the show grow. You know what it is. Go outside, touch grass, and get your tail out the hole. I'm feeling what Shaxxas does to sin. We just love us toxic and we binge. Think we're free when we're on the fringe. But we're lost, yeah, we're lost, yeah, we're lost. Ropes full of death and bones. For all we leave when we chase the most. What we acquire will decompose. What do we want, do we want, do we want? Shadows dance and they came from our masters. Fire's closing in behind us, it don't matter. Corpus dancing to the flicker, hear the laughter. And we just think that it's normal in the past. Prayed in the garden while his friends slept. We're just broken pieces to the gold and no missteps. I'm here to break down all your idols ritualistic. If you don't like it, I don't speak in euphemistic terms. The world is run by Charles Montgomery Burns. They keeping it hooded like CERN. They've done it in thirds before the earth was occurred. And all the friction I'm getting is warranted when your chambers don't echo. The insurance needed for what I be saying don't come from progressive or geckos. And why are you popping Prosecco if you ain't putting in labor? I'm taking shots of espresso every second I fade. But more than the last, we never get a return on time lost with the divine laws. But people looking to rabbit like tacos with lime sauce. Hey, I never cared too much what they saying. Matter of fact, what I'm saying, I ain't here to
explain it on the levels. All they see, but they don't see my creator campaign of politicians for your souls. No debate. After the next, I'm calling them Benedict Arnold. I got me a chopper. Most of our collars are blue. Most of us can't even afford one. Lining up for new iPhones and Jordans. It ain't our blessings, and we praying for misfortune. On others, on our socials, feeling so important. I'm breaking you down. Ain't here to make you feel comfortable. Just avowing the opposite sex while creating the monster's hotness. These hells we create for ourselves. Timelines are nothing but cells. Shadows dance on the cave from my masters. Fires closing in behind us, it don't matter. We'll be dancing to the flicker, hear the laughter. And we just think that it's normal in the past. With the flame.